The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Jonah Sacks. Jonah is an author, speaker, and entrepreneur. He was the founder and CEO of Free Range Studios, where he created groundbreaking campaigns for Amnesty International, Greenpeace, the Human Rights Campaign, and for corporate clients such as Microsoft and Patagonia. He is the author of Winning the Story Wars. His latest book is called Unsafe Thinking: How to Be Nimble and Bold When You Need It Most. Jonah Sacks, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
In the prologue of Unsafe Thinking, you introduce us to Jason Klein, who's the co-founder of the design studio Brandios. And Jason is getting a ton of heat from fans over his rebranding efforts on behalf of a minor league baseball team in Hartford, Connecticut. Why were they mad at him, and why is that, in the end, kind of a good thing?
So Jason was brought in to rename the team, and you know, he asked for 6,000 submissions from the fans. You know, what should we call the team? And got, you know, just a lot of very obvious ones. I think the Huckleberries came in honor of Mark Twain, who was once in the city. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of ideas that mimicked Major League Baseball teams. But the one he went for was called Yard Goats. It was a weird, strange kind of joke name in a way that referenced some of the old rail cars in the old Hartford rail yards.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was considered kind of an insult to the city. You know, Hartford's kind of a struggling, smaller city, and they were looking for something to reinject pride with this new baseball team. And Klein came up with an idea that's sort of unforgettable and very offbeat. This is the kind of stuff Klein does everywhere. Mm-hmm. So in Lehigh, Pennsylvania, he named the team the Iron Pigs, and in El Paso, he named the team Chihuahuas. And what he knows that the fans didn't at the time is that these wacky, wild, and nothing like Major League Baseball team names stick in people's minds.
Right.
And eventually they kind of create an outsider sort of pride in local communities. Like, only we have the Yard Goats, and only we have the Chihuahuas. At Chihuahuas games, people go and eat out of dog bowls, nachos out of dog bowls at the game. And start to, you know, at first they were pissed about it. And then later on, like, hey, this is us. We're different. We're funny. We're having fun. And what Klein says is that minor league baseball can either be a second-rate major league, or it can be this first-rate spectacle. And no one's going to come out to a minor league game expecting to see the Yankees or the Braves, but they come out to see the Yard Goats. You know, they're already in a new frame of mind, and they're already having fun in a different way, and it's kind of a, you know, top-rate spectacle for them. And so his teams are able to sell more merchandise across the country than any kind of conservatively named teams. And they get a kind of radical fan base or fanatical fan base that, you know, just the Hartford Braves would never be able to achieve.
So what I love about this, because it's like the origin story of the book, and I don't know if you know the origin story of why Second City is called the Second City, but it was based on a series of A.J. Liebling articles in The New Yorker where he proclaimed Chicago wasn't even a first city, it was a second city, so it was a put-down.
Uh-huh.
And so this idea of, like, embracing the weird and the secondness and the odd is kind of an interesting pivot point. And you tie the story to your own journey. And you said of yourself, quote, "I was used to improvising my way out of dilemmas, but now when I looked within for answers, I came up empty." And that's the premise of this book. It's that, you know, the safe thinking is not getting it done. And that's something sort of you realized. And so you venture into this whole other area of, well, what does it mean to be an unsafe thinker?
Yeah, exactly. So I had started this social change advertising firm when I was 24 years old, and I just wanted to kind of explore and play. And we started making these fun little viral cartoons to try to get people to take action on social issues, human rights, the environment, etc. And, you know, we'd send them to a few hundred friends, and soon 1,000 and 10,000 and sometimes tens of millions of people would see it, you know, long before YouTube existed. And we were just having a good time. But that led to a certain kind of level of success where the company was growing. And the real problem was people started asking me to give talks as a storytelling expert. Now, I had been this, you know, really passionate explorer and, you know, student of storytelling. But the minute that I made up a bunch of rules and tools for doing it, I started having a lot more answers than I had questions. I started playing a lot less. And as the company grew, I started bringing more rules to the company so that we could get kind of predictable, we could repeat our successes. When people would have questions for me, I would sort of be defensive, you know, if it didn't fit my model of the world. And so even though the company was growing, we were doing better and better, I felt that creativity really being sucked out of me and that we weren't having fun anymore. And the culture of the company was not what it used to be. It wasn't what I had gotten into the game for. And worse than that, I could tell the way that the world of marketing changes, if we didn't get really creative, we were going to go over a cliff before too long. And, you know, when you're 40 people and not two, going over a cliff can be a real disaster.
Yeah, not so good.
No. So I was really stuck between, well, the stuff I'm doing now works and I'm dependent on it, but I know it's not going to work for long. But every single day that I get up, I have to keep doing it. How do I actually change in time? How do I change myself? And it was grueling because, you know, we're just creatures of habit, especially under pressure. And trying to change was so hard. And, you know, my way out was just talking to as many people as could, reading the science on creativity and performance. You know, trying to learn, why do we get stuck in ruts and how do we get out of them? And, you know, that journey for me to get back to what was once sort of, you know, very easy creativity, but was really hard to return to, you know, that's where the book came from.
Yeah, and we should talk about what the problem is with safe thinking, because I don't know that everyone is going to sort of piece that together. And, you know, Ken Robinson talks about this, right, in our educational system. You write in the book, quote, early in our lives, we start learning that originality can come at a cost. We like our patterns, and we like how things go in order, but all creativity tends to come from divergent thinking, but that is not, you're not getting the A in school for that often.
Right. I mean, there's this fascinating study I quote in the book where they ask teachers, you know, how important is it to teach creativity in class? And they rank that often as number one. This is the most important thing we need to teach our kids, is to be creative. But then when they ask them, who are your favorite students, they almost universally pick non-creative kids as their favorite students and creative kids as their least favorite students, because creativity is just disruptive. It's more time. You know, if you're on a single track and you're trying to get from point A to point B, creative people are going to take you off that track, and it's going to be harder in some ways to get to point B, but, you know, perhaps point C is where you need to go. And so, you know, if the world is always changing around us and we're not changing with it, you know, we're kind of applying the same approach, the same methodology, no matter how good that methodology is, it's not going to stay relevant forever. And we need to spend at least some of our time diverging from, you know, the path that we feel comfortable on. You know, a lot of people ask me, like, well, should I always be unsafe? Should I always do the craziest thing I can think of? And, you know, of course that's not the answer. What unsafe thinking means, in my mind, is, you know, the opposite of safe thinking in terms of always doing what makes us feel comfortable, always using parts of our brain that we are, you know, are well practiced in, always staying in our area of expertise. You know, if you're always moving away from anxiety and towards what feels, you know, easy and expedient, you're just eventually going to find that you've lost the thread and you're no longer your creative self. And that's really a problem in a world that demands creativity.
Right. And improvisation in and of itself is a practice in unsafe thinking. I mean, that you are going up with no script whatsoever and inventing on the spur of the moment. And what we have learned is that you can't just send two people up there to do that. That's kind of crazy. That they need to have it be instilled sort of a mindset and habits and practice, mostly to get out of their fear brain. And I've said this a lot, like I did the casting at Second City for well over 20 years. And when we would audition sort of beginning people coming in, this is like 1,000 people we're seeing, we would know the people who are not going to have a successful audition for us because they literally were showing their fear as they walked on the stage, whether they're wiping their brow or they're sweating profusely there. It's like, you can't improvise, and you certainly can't improvise well when you're in your fear brain. And I'll quote you from the book. You say, quote, rather than trying to avoid or fight our anxiety, those who study its nature say we should learn to become more comfortable with this, with the discomfort of it, which lessens the impulse to react in a fight or flight fashion and frees us to be more creative in our response to challenges.
Yeah, you know, I had this idea when I was first writing the book, and I was reaching out to all these people who were, I was now considering to be far more creative than I was, because I was really down on myself and my own creativity. Hmm. I was thinking, you know, I was feeling this constant anxiety and constant fear that we were going to, you know, fall apart. And so I figured that perhaps the people who were really creative and really got out of these ruts were just kind of people who didn't feel fear and just, you know, didn't have to face that anxiety. You know, I write about that old app ad, you know, here's to the crazy ones. Yeah. Just this idea that, you know, just some people are born to break rules. They don't care what other people think. They're going to go their own way. And, you know, it was kind of a depressing thought that I was one of those people. But as I reached out to all these people who were really doing it and, you know, try to figure out what was making them tick, I heard time and again, yeah, this stuff really scares me. It never gets easier. It is hard and it is frightening. But I have learned to see, you know, anxiety as a sign that I'm on my creative edge. That, you know, I remind myself and my team all the time that nothing really creative and good has ever happened when we were feeling comfortable.
Right, 100%.
Yeah, so I that means that, you know, you can never stay in a comfort zone for too long, because if you're in a great comfort zone being successful, you know, someone's going to ask you to do something bigger. You're going to get on a bigger stage where you're no longer in your comfort zone. And if you still are, you need to be on an even bigger stage. And so, you know, we can't avoid anxiety. And the psychological sciences I read really said that the more that you try to avoid anxiety, the more that you're actually going to feel it. This is not a feeling that you can push away. Right. But if you reframe it and say, oh, this is actually a good thing, I need to move towards this at times, that's a very powerful way of making it work for you. So, yeah, using anxiety as fuel for creativity, not a sign that you're going off track, really can change the way that you approach fear and become more creative in your life.
Yeah, that's the same thing with stress, right? You know, that stress isn't inherently bad, but it can be bad if you let it get away from you. You know, high performers are definitely sort of in that sort of good stress, in that stress mode. You also talk about Gandhi reframing his fear, and you said, quote, he began to look on every difficulty as an opportunity for service. That's a really elegant way of describing that particular approach.
Yeah, so the story of Gandhi, if we could just tell it briefly.
Yeah.
Really blew me away. You know, I was thinking, and Gandhi does appear in that Apple ad, by the way,
one of the
crazy ones. And, you know, come on, he was crazy. He was able to, creatively crazy, he was able to bring down the British Empire, you know, without lifting his hand in
a
violent attack. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, he had to do it. You know, how much courage does that take? But I didn't know this. When I read about Gandhi and read his biographies, I found that he was someone who was afraid to open his mouth and utter a single word in public. Mm-hmm. So he had to resign as the, you know, chair of the London Vegetarian Society as a young man because he couldn't give a speech. And then he went home and tried to be a lawyer, but he would be in court and he couldn't speak to the jury because he was so afraid. Mm-hmm. He fled to South Africa, had to flee his family and go somewhere where they wouldn't laugh at him. And, you know, it wasn't until he was kicked off a train for being a brown person in a white person's seat and left on a freezing cold platform in the mountains, that he suddenly realized, and he calls it, you know, I really think beautifully, the most creative incident of his life.
Mm-hmm.
This understanding that the more that he was running away from the things that frightened him, the more fear he was feeling, the more frightening his life became. And he made a deal with himself that he was going to try to move towards those things, see, you know, yeah, difficulty as an opportunity for service. And just make that shift now. Like, I don't think we'll all become Gandhi, you know, tomorrow by making that shift. There was something really, you know, powerful within him that allowed him to do what he did. But that change unleashed, you know, tremendous possibility for him. And I think that when we get into the situations where we're feeling flooded and overloaded with a little bit too much stress, you know, we might tell ourselves that we've, you know, congratulate ourselves for bringing ourselves to this point and getting out of bed and getting out of the couch and doing something that really challenges us. At the same time, we do need to be careful. You can't stay in stress forever. A lot of the people I talk to, you know, talked about kind of this idea of risk portfolios where,
yeah,
you know, this inventor at Google X I spoke to told me that, you know, if work is really risky, go home and just watch Netflix and not do anything. Won't see anybody. He'll hang out at home.
Mm-hmm.
If work gets a little boring, you know, he'll go on his motorcycle and ride along the Pacific Coast Highway, you know, as fast as he can. It's just like we need to be able to get that stress going, get that fear going, and push ourselves to the edge, but we also need to give ourselves plenty of time to recuperate. We can't stay in that zone forever.
Yeah, it's the same with athletes, right? And I think artists as well is and Adam Grant talks about that too, the need, the powerful importance of daydreaming as a way to sort of get to a creative product. And this is actually overall one of the things I really recommend in this book, because I read a lot of the same studies that you read and the work that I do up at University of Chicago with the Center for Decision Research. And you are able to translate a lot of this sort of weighty stuff in a very applicable way for people to understand, oh, I see how this plays out in my life or work. And I found this study, which I was not aware of, around distraction, and this was the researchers at Carnegie Mellon, to be incredibly interesting. I'll set it up and I want you to talk about, but essentially participants were divided into three groups. One group read some text and answered questions, and the other two groups were told that at any moment they might be given further instructions via instant message. And indeed, those last two groups were texted twice while they were reading, and that proved, problematic in terms of their comprehension. But that, like, this next leg of the study to me was the real surprise.
Yeah, so that study, I'm surprised and happy that you prefaced it by saying that I'm explaining things in ways that are easy to understand. I struggled in writing up this study probably more than any other.
Oh, that's great.
But, yeah. It's not an easy one. But here's basically what it did. So some of the people got distracted by text message in the first time, and then, others didn't. And, it was predictable. If you got distracted by text message, it was hard to do your task. But then they had one group that was told you might be distracted by text message, or groups were told they might be distracted, and one group wasn't told that at all. Of the two groups that were told they might be, only one was. So the group that was told they might be distracted but actually wasn't outperformed in their task, either the group that was distracted or the group that never was. And that was a big, there was a performance boost by being aware that distraction might be coming, but steering yourself against it. And I thought that was really, really powerful and amazing, because, we live in this world of constant distraction. Right now we're having a conversation and both of our email inboxes are probably filled up. We both could be checking our phones. I'm not sure what you're doing, but
I'm not checking my phone.
Right now, but would be normal.
Yeah.
So we have these sort of constant parts of our brain that are asked to be vigilant if we're not vigilant, we're going to let these distractions in, and that is a productivity and creativity killer, absolutely. So, but if we can be aware of those things that are most likely to distract us while we're trying to do our creative work and sort of, surface them, especially if we're in a meeting and say, hey, listen, this is a time of day when we get a lot of texts from customers or a lot of calls, the switchboard, so to speak, starts lighting up. Let's all agree to put our phones in this basket in the middle of the table while we meet for the next 30 minutes. Or let's agree that we're going to turn off notifications in this way. If you name the most common intrusions in the creative process, name them and then put them aside, you're creating this cone of focus that both turns on your vigilance, you're becoming aware of distraction, and also pushes that distraction away. And that's where, this study and some other science I read really suggests you can harness your focus, thus your creativity.
Yeah, that's a really interesting zag, where you thought there'd be a zig. And I thought about in terms of our work, because I often call improvisation noisy group mindfulness. For many people who have a mindfulness practice, right, they're not having a bunch of people like shout at them, which is, on stage or even an audience. But what you are developing in your practice of improvisation is to very mindfully, I often say we mindfully linger inside mistakes. We kind of allow ourselves just to play with whatever comes next. And we know that there's other stuff out there fighting for our attention, but we're going to stay in here. And that tends to lead towards peak creativity. I mean, there. When I tried to explain why so many famous people have come out of Second City, why it went from Mike Nichols and Elaine May to Colbert and Tina Fey and John Candy and Bill Murray, it's like there wasn't the same casting director for all those years, right? It's this practice that allows these really talented people to achieve their top performance, and they take it with them.
In the big picture, I think that absolutely this kind of putting yourself on the creative edge of improvisation is just, captures so many of these principles of taking risks, of being present, of being aware, of sort of really getting that feedback about what's working and what's not working. So all of those things, it's kind of a crash course in some ways in expanding your thinking palette. So it's not surprising, that so many people can come out of an intentional program of creativity like that.
So I'm talking about all these sort of masters and these, you could call them experts. But there is another edge to that, right? We've got this sort of expert syndrome. The quote I took from the book was, expertise can be a terrible thinking trap. So people are going to be like, well, wait a sec, you just talked about like these sort of experts. But yeah, expertise can be a problem.
Yeah, I found this fascinating. You know, this really is what connects to my personal story, which was, you know, the big boost of feeling like, hey, I arrived, people care about what I have to say, I'm somebody in the world, and then that really turning against me and destroying what got me there, in a sense, or really threatening to. So, you know, I came across a fascinating study by a guy named Philip Tetlock, who I wound up talking to for the book. And, you know, he studied experts over 20 years. They made tens of thousands of predictions. And he found that they were worse than dart-throwing monkeys at making predictions about the future. And, you know, that blew me away. I was like, yeah, how is that even possible that, you know, you have to try to be worse than a dart-throwing monkey? And he said that what happens is, as we attach our egos and sense of self to a particular way of seeing the world, new data, you know, starts to just become an intrusion. We don't want new information because we're comfortably sitting in our lane of expertise and we see everything. It's easy and fast to process, and we look at something and, you know, feel really good about ourselves because we can see the pattern where no one else can because we're experts. But if the pattern that we keep seeing is no longer, you know, relevant, then we start being blind. It's called expert blindness. Mm-hmm. So if you're playing a two-dimensional game like chess where the rules never change, you can just keep gaining more and more expertise, and that's a good thing. But if you're playing games where the rules are ill-defined and keep changing, you're actually, you know, the more you're investing your sense of self and thinking quickly based on your expertise, actually the harder it is for you to adapt and beginners start to beat you. So there's this concept of entrenchment, which is that you get to a certain peak of understanding of your field, and you really need a deep understanding of your field to innovate within it, but you get to this certain peak and then you cross over into the sort of fixed mindset where you can't be sensitive to what the environment's telling you anymore. And that's where you get over the edge. And so what I really talk about in the book is, we can't just be beginners and care nothing for learning and care nothing for mastering our fields. That doesn't work. But what we can do is see ourselves not as experts, but explorers. You know, mm-hmm. explorers are people who are passionate about gaining new information and passionate about learning, but never really attach their sense of self to what they know. And that seems to be the hack that really seems to work.
So when you did the deep dive into all this research, like, did you have some level of Sherpa? I mean, what led you to this?
Well, you know, I've always been interested in stories. As I said at the beginning, that, you know, asking people, you know, not relying simply on facts, but really getting people's personal stories, to me, is always how people learn and how mm-hmm. I like to communicate, you know, is really on the story level. So my first impulse was, let's go out there and talk to all the people who I admire, to find out what they did. But I also found that, you know, knowing who to talk to, that, you know, people I admired was not the longest list ever, and it wasn't comprehensive in any particular way. Mm-hmm. So I started thinking, you know, I need something better than this. I need a guide. You know, what buckets and realms do I need to even be looking? And I was, you know, truly a beginner at this. I was like, what does science even know about creativity? Is this even a realm of science that's well-trodden? And, of course, you know, it is in huge ways. And so when I opened up that can of worms to start looking into what do we know about the, you know, basics of what you need to be creative so that I could start looking for people's stories within it, I just got hooked. I just got sucked into this world of the social sciences and mm-hmm. all the things that we've learned about this thing that feels, I don't know, I guess creativity feels like magic or undefinable, but, you know, science has a way of bringing insights to even the most, you know, dark reaches of the human soul. So, yeah, I learned a huge amount by diving in like that.
So because we have a similar trajectory, you know, I produced at Second City for, you know, about 25, 26 years and kind of was like, and I wrote my book and I was on the, you know, book circuit and I kind of thought that was cool and having a bit of a midlife crisis and literally sort of like I quit my job and was given sort of the lifeline of, hey, just be a consultant here, hang out for a year. And then we had this fire at Second City that all our administrative offices were completely like gutted. And we got moved into sort of a temporary office and I was jammed in with the guys in the corporate group. And that's how I found myself on the campus at the University of Chicago thinking I was having a meeting about how could we tie together improvisation with maybe an expert in negotiation. That sort of academic in negotiation brought his wife who ran the Center for Decision Research. And then suddenly I'm like in an executive education, you know, workshop with Richard Thaler and digging into sort of behavioral science. And I did the same sort of like, oh, this is incredibly rich. And it kind of gives me a new language to apply to my expertise. And in so doing, it changes and actually improves my expertise. It seems like you kind of went through that too.
Yeah, yeah. And it really, hearing you tell the story, not hearing myself tell the story, reminds me that there's a real principle behind this that this is illustrating really nicely, which is when we spend a lot of time in our zone of expertise, you know, entrenchment is something that often follows. But the best thing that you can do to break that trap, besides taking on this identity of an explorer, is to start doing things that you're really not good at.
Yeah.
To do things that are way outside of your areas of knowledge and experience. You know, it could be some people taking a dance class, you know, a singing class, you know, obviously getting into an improv group if that's something new to you. For people like you, that might be reading the sciences, you know, just jumping into something you thought you couldn't. And what happens is not only does it humble you and you know, keeps your ego in check, which is important, but it also brings up all kinds of new analogies and ways of seeing what you already know. So, you know, we're going to look at that science, you know, through a particular lens, and we're going to, you know, we're going to apply it back to the creative process that we're already, you know, good at and into. And so that happens in a million different ways. You know, Steve Jobs is probably most famous for it when he brought, you know, his random interest in Zen aesthetics to computers, like what a strange thing to do, and it has such a powerful impact. You know, I talked to Ed Catmull for the book, the CEO of Pixar. It was pretty bizarre that he was into animation and computers at the same time in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Followed both of those passions to invent a whole industry. So yeah, just like if you just do anything you're not good at, it does some important tricks on the brain and makes you more creative. And not easy to find the time for that for a lot of people, but you know, like everything else, being addicted to speed and efficiency will eventually lead you to a dead end. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Pretty soon I'm going to ask you about your SN story, but I want to throw a couple of, there's so much in this book I'm not getting to, and I literally have like five more pages of notes. It's ridiculous. Here's a phrase I love, two phrases, intelligent disobedience and articulated dissent. We just interviewed Charlene Nemeth, who wrote a book called In Defense of Troublemakers. She's a Stanford Press professor who talks about the power of dissent to challenge our pattern thinking. And you're touching on this with some other research, but this idea that you kind of need the rebel in the brain to get you to maybe open up.
Yeah. Definitely. You know, creativity is rule breaking, and rules exist to bring predictability, and you know, every organization needs them, but organizations where everyone follows the rules will always get a kind of predictable outcome. And so, you know, our best thinkers are breaking rules within our organizations already, and we're all you know, great creative thinkers are breaking the rules of their field already. But how do we, you know, most productively manage it, even encourage it to get the most creativity out of people? So, you know, two things that I thought were really great was this intelligent disobedience is this idea that comes from the world of guide dog trainings, where mm-hmm. a guide dog can be trained to absolutely listen to its master, often who's blind, to do anything the master says. But if the master tells the guide dog to walk in front of a truck, the guide dog, you know, could be trained to do that. It's actually trained to know when to disobey a command when it's not good for it's not good for the team.
Mm.
And, you know, that has been taken into business and onto teams to be teaching people how to get clear and direct about disobeying orders that aren't good for the team itself. And the trick, and this goes the same, it's kind of related to articulated dissent, it's much better if people are doing that above board. If people are reporting back, you know, that's not a good rule, I'm not going to follow it, let
right.
me show you this workaround I've created, and suddenly everyone can benefit. Because the workarounds that are happening in any company are often making the company much more efficient, but no one talks about it because they don't want to be punished. Turns out that people who break rules out in the open are judged to be more loyal and more trustworthy than people who break rules underground or even break rules at all. So if you break rules in the open and let people know about it and disobey not for because you hate rules, but because you're so committed to the group and you talk about that, you can find yourself being more valued at work. And then organizations that tell these stories that don't just say, oh, well, it's okay to break rules or we'll look the other way, but celebrate and tell stories of rule breakers, they don't descend into, you know, free-for-alls. They tend to get people to feel more creative, more willing to be honest about what they're actually doing. And that's even more important than getting people to follow the rules, is to be transparent about their actions. So all kinds of cool stuff about breaking rules that I discovered. And I also discovered that, you know, some of the worst rules that hold us back is our own morality, our own sense of morality.
Hmm.
It doesn't mean that we should, you know, do the wrong thing just for the sake of it. But a lot of times we shut down our creative options because, you know, we have these deeply held values, especially about who we'll talk to and who we'll hang out with and who we'll collaborate with. And, you know, it turns out that people who have more ability to deal with their enemies and their critics and face them head on and even collaborate with them often find the more creative solutions. So strict companies that are based on sort of a strict cultural fit often become these sort of conformist monocultures, and they don't even realize what they're missing, their kind of high-minded morality.
Well, right, and this is now so intensified in our current culture in this country, where we are tribing up, and we are shutting out, and we're defriending, right? And we're
yeah.
It's like, if you want to get to, we had on Ori Brofman with Martin Dempsey, who have written this book called Radical Inclusion. They very much contend that in a decentralized world, you need to be talking to everyone, including your enemy. And I believe the great religions and philosophies promote that same thinking. No one is saying you're going to get to truth by shutting out an entire community of people.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's our ability to do this is getting worse and worse,
right.
Partly because when we think about even trying, we think about doing it, you know, on the Internet. All right, let me go and see what's, you know, in my case, being on Fox News. You know, let me go follow some Trump supporting, you know, someone on Twitter who supports Trump. Let me just see so I can expose myself to new thinking. Well, it turns out that in that medium, when you expose yourself to opposing thinking, it actually more deeply intensifies the views you hold.
Yeah.
So it brings to mind all the objections, and you get deeper and deeper invested in what you already thought.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't happen when you meet somebody face-to-face, it turns out.
Yeah.
So this idea that we might spread our wings a little bit by, you know, checking out some other corners of the Internet only makes the problems much worse. We really need to bring people onto our teams, into our collaborations, who don't think like us. You know, not people who wish us ill necessarily, but people who are willing to give us a new perspective. I tell this in the book that I love, and it connects to that what you're saying about the world's religions, of a pastor in Boston who was part of the Boston Miracle, which, you know, brought murder rates down 67%.
Mm-hmm.
He was trying to work with the at-risk youth that he was afraid were going to fall in with the gangs and the murderers on his street because there was a lot of murder going on. And, you know, he hated the kids who were killing, but he thought he could save the kids who were, you know, on the edge. Well, it turns out until he walked the streets and met the actual killers, you know, who turned out to be scared kids who know how else to live their lives, he couldn't figure out the solution. But once he actually started collaborating with these people who, as a, you know, as a pastor, had a moral, you know, revulsion for their actions, once he connected with them as human beings, they were able to solve the problems and have a huge impact on, you know, on Boston society and across America. So I thought that was just such a good example. I mean, if you can work with murderers, you can work with anybody, it seems.
Right. This topic came up in our lab. So the lab is set up with scholars and improv experts. And as we started talking about it, we're like, oh, we have an exercise that does this. And we get a group in a circle, and we it's called I'm Somebody Who. And the person leading the exercises says, okay, when you identify with one of the aspects that I'm going to yell out, you need to move to a new part of the circle. So it starts with things like, you know, I'm somebody who is wearing green. I'm someone who likes a sunny day. And then it starts to go into things like, I'm somebody who hunts. I'm someone who doesn't believe in climate change. Or I'm somebody who's Catholic. I'm someone who has social anxiety. And what you start to realize, because you're physically watching these people move, and you're like, man, the vegan voted for Trump, which is not what I thought would come together. And it really creates this like, oh, when the differences are in front of me, they become less scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you see, there's sort of another human being on the other side of the table who shares many characteristics and many goals and hopes that you do. And, you know, some of these deep divisions that make us so angry are really just caricatures
and
stereotypes. And, you know, you can kind of laugh about it after a while. I think one of the things that's actually scary, I touch on this in the book. I don't know if I got as deeply into it as I could because it seems so complicated, but I'll try right now, see if it makes any sense on a podcast, is that in some ways, if we were going to go face-to-face with someone who we thought was a monster, we might feel more comfortable than going face-to-face with someone who we think might be charming and lovely and share different views than us, because there's a huge cost to changing our views. We might fear we have to leave our tribe or disappoint our friends or betray our values. So if you're going to meet someone who, you know, is a wonderful human being, but, you know, is a hunter and you're a vegan, you know, you're just setting yourself up for knowing you might actually be influenced by this person. And so in some ways, you want to avoid them even more. And so just accepting that it's okay to listen to other people, and that when you do, you're not really debating with them. You don't have to. The point of the interaction is not that one person will change their opinion. You know, I love this thing that I heard from Joan Blades, the founder of Move On, who started a group with one of the founders of the Tea Party to have actual tea parties in people's houses to discuss politics. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, we never change each other's minds. But now when we hear about these issues, we think about our friends and what our friends think about it on the other side, and it just gives us a richer understanding, and we're not so tribalized, even if our minds aren't changing. You know, our compassion and empathy is growing. You know, that's a great way to approach an awkward conversation. Mm-hmm. Not that, you know, someone has to win and someone has to lose, but that everyone can learn.
Yep, lowering the temperature. Okay, we always end the podcast this way. We ask our guest if there's a time in their life when, and this is probably a softball question for you, where they would normally say no, but instead, and they didn't just say yes, they said yes and what happened? Do you have one of those stories for us?
I do. I mean, in this context, it's probably not the expected one, but I worked so hard to embrace this changing of this company that I had run for 17 years, started as a kid, and it was kind of my core identity. It was who I was, and it was so hard to take this journey to sort of fix it up and change its trajectory. And kind of figured I was doing it because because this is who I am and this is what I'll always do, and I have no choice but to kind of fix it. I found that when I said yes to that journey, I had to really double down on my belief and commitment in the whole project, not just throw it all away. But for me, the yes and was to take that journey to as far as I could with it, and then also to be open to this reality that in learning about all this creative openness, that I could both feel success in that and embrace, you know, walking away. So for me, one of the hardest decisions I ever made in my life, and what I thought was perhaps the unsafe decision I made, was to sell and walk away from the only job I've ever known and set out on a, you know, entirely new creative path. And it wasn't a kind of either-or for me. It was sort of to do the work I knew I needed to do here and to also spread my wings there. So, you know, it was a very internal challenge, but perhaps it's one I ever face, and I feel like I kind of honored both sides of it.
Absolutely. The book is called Unsafe Thinking. Jonah Sacks, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for a great discussion.